Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, with Billy Joel fading out in the background. If you think that at one point I should switch it up and get a new intro music, please do tweet me at WirtzBill. That's W-I-R-T-Z, Bill. This is the episode of January 14, 2021. I think unlike last time, I did get the date right this time. So let me double check. Yeah, 7 plus 7 does make 14. I hope you're having a wonderful week and that one of your New Year's resolutions is making a small donation to support our work here at the Consumer Choice Center. You can do that by becoming a member. Instructions on consumerchoicecenter.org. Thanks for your support. My guest on this week's episode is Alex Braley. He's an expert on all things Brexit, having worked for both the European Commission and the British government. Alex Braley now works for the European Public Affairs Consultancy, FIPRA. Now that he's in the private sector, he's allowed to give interviews, and I thought let's add more information to what we've already heard from James Holland in last week's episode. But more on that later on. First, Donald Trump has been banned from the popular social media networks Facebook and Twitter for inciting violence in light of the recent Capitol Hill riots in Washington, D.C. At least he's banned at the moment that I'm recording this podcast. The news these days moves so quickly, you never really know what's going on. Here's CBS reporting.
Mr. Trump lost his primary megaphone overnight when Twitter permanently shut down his personal account, breaking off his connection to nearly 90 million followers. They also suspended one used by his campaign. This is calls from both Democrats and some Republicans intensify for the president to resign or face a potential second impeachment for inciting Wednesday's deadly storming of the U.S. Capitol.
Now, this is also relevant for a European audience because we've had these same conversations over here in the European Union. And because the sitting president of the United States getting banned on social media, that's a really big deal and signal. It's really sparked a debate over free speech and the influence of big network players, which we've had in the EU for well over 2 years now. Here's France 24 from back in February last year.
European Industry Commissioner Thierry Breton didn't mince words after a meeting with Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Online platforms now have a responsibility, an obvious responsibility towards our fellow citizens, towards all of us. If all the platforms operating on the European continent do not comply with the conditions I have just mentioned, we'll be obligated to intervene, and more strictly.
New EU laws are set to roll in at the end of this year, and they could penalize tech giants that fail to rein in hate speech and disinformation.
In 2018, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was at a hearing in the European Parliament where he was quizzed about Facebook's responsibility when it comes to hate speech online.
Refugees arriving in Europe are using Facebook to stay in touch with their loved ones back home and find new communities here. There are 18 million small businesses here in Europe that use Facebook today, mostly for free, almost half of whom say that they have hired more people as a result of their use of our tools. But it's also become clear over the last couple of years that we haven't done enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, foreign interference in elections, and developers misusing people's information. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a mistake, and I'm sorry for it.
So the EU is still ironing out how the Digital Services Act can precisely remove hateful and illicit content. And in the process, we have discovered that in the effort of trying to clean up the internet, governments are being too broad. By the way, as a side note, I recommend the documentary Meet the Censors by Norwegian filmmaker Halvard Fossum. I watched it recently on Amazon Prime and I think it's very interesting because it explores the question of censorship from the perspective of those who initiate it with a filmmaker who supports it. So very thought-provoking there, I quite enjoyed it. But we need to make some things clear here. One conversation is about censorship, so the government actively going out there and deleting your content, or punishing you for publishing it, for instance. European countries have increasingly chosen the route of nudging the platforms to do the work for them. This basically means that Facebook or Twitter get a fine by the government if illicit content remains on the platforms. We often hear of a 48-hour rule. Platforms could then be obligated to use so-called upload filters, so basically automatize the process of checking each video, tweet, or post. This is because the sheer amount of content on all of these platforms is so large
that you cannot possibly check all of it in real time, and especially not manually. I don't think making social media platforms the sheriffs of the internet is a good idea, though. Now, the last option is for social media platforms to self-organize the curation of their content. This is largely what they've been doing, and it's their prerogative, by the way. If you use Facebook or Twitter, you sign an agreement. Some of your data will be used for marketing purposes. This is, for instance, why I receive ads for craft beer, which I quite enjoy. And you agree to the community guidelines, which lay out what you can and cannot post. It makes sense for the platforms to remove certain things. And by the way, on platforms such as Facebook, you can delete comments on your own post. So you do get to do your own curation as well. Whether it's good for Facebook or Twitter that they deleted the account of President Trump is a good question, by the way. I personally think the events warranted a reaction, but I also think that they've opened quite a Pandora's box here. It doesn't take much scrolling on Twitter before you see a myriad of calls for other people to be banned as well. How far that's going to go, we shall see. In other news then, a new tax on sweetened drinks in Poland is rightfully creating upset. The Polish government introduced a new tax of 11 euro cents per litre, plus a variable tax depending on the amount of sugar. Additionally, there's a 2 euro cents per litre tax on all drinks that contain caffeine. So a store-bought iced coffee can very quickly increase in price upwards of 20%. The Polish Prime Minister, when criticized about this tax, said that mature countries have already done this. And he asked the question, does Poland want to be an immature country? Now, of course, the goal of many of these taxes is to raise additional revenue, there's no doubt about that. But the comment on maturity is interesting. How exactly is it a move of maturity to tax consumers for behavior they have chosen themselves? I actually think it's infantilizing consumers to tell them what they cannot eat. Adding to that, we don't know that sugar taxes actually work. Here's Alberto Nadelli in a video for The Guardian in 2015.
Do the numbers add up? Flat, indirect taxes, such as sin taxes, hit the poorest hardest. People in the bottom fifth of the income stream, who drink moderately, smoke and drive a car, spend about 37% of their disposable household income on sin taxes and VAT. The comparable figure for people in the top fifth of the income stream is 15%. And there's little evidence that an increase in the price of sugary drinks nudges people towards healthier alternatives. In October 2011, Denmark introduced a tax on foods high in saturated fat. The obesity tackling measure made pizza, oils, dairy products, bacon and butter more expensive. But then, a year later, the tax was reversed. Why? Well, authorities said the measure had inflated food prices so much that jobs were at risk. And some people were just crossing the border to Germany to get their food.
Also, that's right. If you're a high-income earner, you probably won't notice the difference of such a tax on your consumption. Now, of course, you'll have people who will say that it's a good thing that this tax hits low-income people, because they're the least educated and we want them to live longer. And I'm not strawmanning here, by the way. Here's billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who is also global ambassador for non-communicable diseases for the World Health Organization.
Some people say, well, taxes are regressive, but in this case, yes, they are. That's the good thing about them, because the problem is in people that don't have a lot of money. And so higher taxes should have a bigger impact on their behavior and how they deal with themselves. So I listen to people saying, oh, we don't want to tax the poor. Well, we want the poor to live longer so that they can get an education and enjoy life. And that's why you do want to do exactly what a lot of people say you don't want to do.
Bottom line here seems to be, if you're poor, you're not very smart, and you should have the government take care of you. Really wonder why Michael Bloomberg's run for president didn't go that far. In other news then, the UK is currently reviewing its legislation on genetic engineering, which puts the European Union under pressure. Due to legislation dating back to 2001, almost all GMOs are banned in the European Union, and the only type of GMO maize currently cultivated exists in only a handful of European countries. Here's a video from the European Parliament from back in 2015.
Proponents of GMOs argue the main benefit is higher productivity, then resistance to pests, rodents and disease, which they say in turn reduces the need for pesticides. GMOs, they say, could also increase the capacity of plants to deal with harsh weather. Opponents argue GMOs present unknown perils to humans, animals, and biodiversity. They say vital agricultural pollinators such as bees or butterflies are threatened.
The problem here is that the first part is said by scientists and the second one isn't. GMOs are safe and so are newer gene editing practices. The great irony, by the way, is that modern gene editing technologies have been developed in Europe by European scientists, but due to our own rules, we're not allowed to use them. Meanwhile, countries such as the US, Canada, and Brazil are leading the charge when it comes to new innovations. In agriculture, we can do great things with genetic engineering. For instance, create nuts that don't cause harm to people with nut allergies, or gluten-free wheat, which helps people with a gluten intolerance, or celiac disease. The number of innovations here are uncountable, and the UK is right to argue for a reform. Question is, of course, how such a legal change could affect trade with the European Union. I for myself believe that the EU should also change its rules. By the way, if you want to know more about how the COVID-19 vaccine was produced through genetic engineering, you can listen to the episode of December 31st where I talked about that issue. If you're also interested on how other regions regulate gene editing technologies, the Consumer Choice Center produced a gene editing regulation tracker in 2020 together with a genetic literacy project. You can find this under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. In other news then, Belgium and other European countries are discussing the merits of vaccine certificates. Basic premise here, if you're not vaccinated, you don't get to cross borders, go to bars, and so on. Not planning on that, says the UK government. Here's Michael Gove on Sky News when asked about it last month.
People in this country have common sense. The overwhelming majority can see that getting vaccinated is not just good for you, it's also good for others. It's a way of making sure that granny and granddad, mum and dad are safe.
OK, so there won't be a vaccine passport?
No, that's not being planned.
At all, ever?
I certainly am not planning to introduce any vaccine passports, and I don't know anyone else in government.
But other countries are seeing it differently, with digital solutions as to how to do it. Here's ABC News from last month.
Now that coronavirus vaccines are being administered all across the country and around the world, several companies are developing a so-called vaccine passport. Smartphone apps like the Common Pass app allow people to upload details of their COVID-19 test results and vaccinations to create digital credentials. Those credentials could then be shown to enter concert venues or stadiums, movie theaters, offices, or even international travel. At this time right now, though, there is no such requirement.
There are, of course, legal implications if such a passport were to be implemented. Most countries will not make the vaccine mandatory, but they can ask you to basically identify yourself with a vaccine passport, especially when it comes to the Schengen zone. I don't think we should have vaccine passports, mostly because it fundamentally infringes on the liberties of people to move freely. For instance, if Italy introduces a vaccine requirement, but Greece doesn't, well, then you will need to show your ID and vaccine passport at the Italian border on arrival, despite having stayed in the Schengen zone. Now, you could say, maybe the airline will do that. But airlines only check your ID to verify that you are the person traveling on that ticket. If the airline does not require vaccination, then you would need governments to check it. If you were to require airlines to check for vaccinations, then you're outsourcing important immigration requirements to airlines. Let alone, by the way, that it's not just airlines, but also ferries, trains, people traveling by car. There's no end to how people will enter your country. I think it's an administration nightmare, and it's really coercion. There's good reasons for those who are vulnerable to get the vaccine, but the strategy should be to liberate everyone from restrictions as soon as those people have received their vaccinations. Not going to solve the entire pandemic in one podcast, though. Let's move on to the interview of this week. My guest is Alex Braley, a Brexit expert who has worked for both the EU and the United Kingdom for years, and he has seen the ups and downs of Brexit unfolding in real time. We had Brexit as an issue already last week, but I wanted to give you, the listeners, more information. So Alex, the new trade relationship between the UK and the EU is now in force, but many people are wondering how this actually works in practice. So let's just start off and let's just give people a few topics where they can understand what this new trade relationship means for them. So let's go to customs. So if I'm in the UK and I'm ordering online, or if I'm an EU citizen and I bring goods to the UK, can you tell us a bit what the new limitations are? What are the rules here?
So first of all, I think the obvious point and salient point to make is that things will become more difficult. Answering sort of some very specific questions that you raised in terms of how much alcohol can I bring back from the continent to the UK, the famous question, there are now, rather than no restrictions, there are thresholds. So you can bring up to £390 worth of goods on 40 litres of beer. And for us Brits, very important, up to 4 litres of spirits. If you're ordering online, you risk sort of further costs as well. So there's a threshold at which you will pay customs, €22 for business, €45 for individuals. So the sort of message there is don't treat yourself to something too expensive. But those are some of the sort of very practical implications. If we look at the bigger picture, if we look at sort of trade in goods, we hear stories now about people having their ham sandwiches confiscated at the border. Because when you're in a different regulatory space and with the deal that we've got, those changes do matter, and you cannot any longer just take your meat, your sort of food across. Now, the conversation focuses quite heavily on goods and tariff barriers and restrictions, quotas, because that's very tangible to people. But the big change really here is non-tariff barriers. What are non-tariff barriers? So these are sort of all the extra paperwork people have to fill, all the rules businesses have to abide by, the things you don't necessarily see straight away. And by leaving the EU, what really changes for UK businesses is that we're no longer part of the EU ecosystems. And that means essentially UK businesses are no longer treated like EU businesses when conducting operations in EU member states. So in the past, if a UK company felt it was being discriminated against unfairly, perhaps on grounds of nationality, it could go to the European Commission, it could go to the Court of Justice, and it would probably be a productive outcome for it. However, now we're entirely in the hands of that member state's goodwill to do something about it. And that's a real change for UK business.
But on the other hand, there's also the possibility to diverge from the regulatory standards of the European Union. You know, we had some examples talked about already by the UK government, for instance, on genetic engineering. That's one of the issues. Do you think there's going to be a lot of divergence on the standards of goods? And if so, what does that mean for this trade relationship? Because right now, with, you know, there's similar regulations, there's similar rules. But what happens if the UK diverges significantly? What does that mean for the deal we have right now?
Brexit is about doing things differently, and that obviously translates into this word you'll hear a lot around, the sort of Brussels bubble, which is divergence. Now, if you look at the deal, it's mainly driven by defensive interests, I would say, and that's what culminates in the level playing field. On the one hand, the UK wanting to safeguard its sovereignty, so no mentions of the Court of Justice, no too stringent level playing provisions, although there are mechanisms in the trade agreement that I'll come to in a second. And on the EU side, it was about safeguarding the integrity of the single market. In terms of divergence, the deal does cater for that scenario. That's, I think, why that was the main sticking point of the negotiation. So you have this rebalancing mechanism, which goes beyond what you'll find in most standard trade agreements, but it's not quite the dynamic alignment which the EU had initially asked for. Will the UK actually diverge? It's difficult to say. It really depends on it. The direction of the current government is clear. It wants to boost innovation. It wants to boost tech companies. It wants to boost digital companies. How they actually do that, whether that's in terms of subsidizing, in terms of relaxing regulations, and how sort of that deregulation translates into maintaining environmental standards, where the UK has been quite clear that it wants to be a global leader on this with COP26 coming up. All of that remains to be seen, but there is a framework to deal with this. And in many ways, all of those unanswered questions have been left for later, because you see quite an elaborate governance structure with the Partnership Council and lots of committees sitting below that. So the UK will continue to have a strong presence in Brussels, and lots of UK diplomats will be attending EU meetings, just in a slightly different format going forward.
We'll get to other practical issues later, but first, because we're already talking about the trade relationship, I'm reading that in Norway there's been a discussion about this deal for the UK being actually better than what they have. Is that true? How do you evaluate this deal?
So I think the first thing to say is the deal is an achievement, and we should praise both sides for having got there. Ultimately, it depends how you measure it. And I think this comes back to the fundamentals of the Brexit debate. If sovereignty is your overarching goal and your baseline, then it looks like a good deal because it restores UK sovereignty in full. If you're looking at it from an economic perspective, it is less integrated than other models out there. If you want to take the sovereignty approach, that's a fair, a legitimate position, an argument to make. We just need to be honest about the trade-offs, and that was lacking a bit, perhaps until the end of 2020, when, as we were approaching the exits, businesses had needed to prepare, so the government started to put out notices on what governments needed to do. It really depends how you're measuring this. If you look at the trade agreement itself, it goes further than some standard trade agreements in some areas, but it also goes less further in others. So, for example, with the Japan or New Zealand, if you take a specific example like sanitary and phytosanitary provisions, if you look at conformity assessments and mutual recognition of those, there are existing EU trade deals that go further. And this is hugely important because the lack of ambitious provisions for those matters means that on SPS, so phytosanitary provisions, food, plants, all this, that is now a unilateral EU decision whether to list the UK as a third country eligible to sort of do the trade on that. You have to look at this at a different lens than sort of Norway or your Switzerland's. Why? Just because, and this was very clear in the Brexit debate and negotiations, whereas for the EU, it's more about managing Switzerland and Norway and keeping the flows going. The UK, due to its size, due to its history, due to its global influence and position, is a competitor. And the UK hasn't shied away from saying that it will do things differently to also be more competitive. So this is a new form of third country relationship with a different logic underpinning it. It does leave the door open to build on in future. Foreign policy, for example, is an area where there's nothing at the moment, but that could be built up in the coming years. But equally, it's far from uncertain that things will go that way. As we were discussing before, the UK decides to diverge, then we begin to trigger more acrimonious mechanisms of the deal, and things could also go wrong very quickly. It's worth noting, therefore, that the agreement does include several review clauses, a suspension clause. So we're in very delicate territory at the moment, and the next 12 months will be really important.
And we'll get to that at the end. But first, there is one thing that people, of course, are very interested in, especially in our line of work, and that's travel. Until the 1st of January, I travel to the UK. I only need to show my ID. What do I need to do now? And what do UK citizens need to do when they come to the Schengen area?
It depends a bit who you are and what the purpose of your travel is. As most people go to Europe for holidays, that will still be possible without a visa, but you will want to consider taking more stringent health insurance because provisions there have changed a little bit. If you are going for work purposes or you have a second home, for example, there is now a new limit, which means you can only be in the EU for 90 out of 180 days. So that's the big change. That will probably apply to a minority, but it's worth noting. I think it's also worth saying on this two further things. First of all, UK citizens will now be in the all passports queue rather than the EU passports queue. So you might need to add a bit of travel time when taking your Eurostar or plane. But more importantly, what we must also bear in mind is that we've almost created two categories of status now within UK and EU citizens through the withdrawal agreement. So people like myself who are resident in the EU on the 31st of December 2359 will continue to be able to reside here indefinitely. So I don't have to leave after 180 days. But for, let's say, the younger generation wanting to live in the EU now, that will be different. They will have to apply for study or work visas, and that will add time, costs. I was very fortunate. I studied in France and I got a grant from the French state. All of that is likely to be shut off or become much more difficult for third country nationals, and fees are likely to be higher in some instances too. But that's a two-way street. So for EU citizens going to the UK, it's more difficult too. And we do see some sad stories come out from that. I teach the EU at my old university, and a student of mine recently told me he was thinking about applying to Oxford for a master's, but the costs are just prohibitive now. These things do really have an impact on people.
So what happens now when young UK citizen get frustrated with the customs rules, the travel rules, and you know, they start businesses and they're frustrated with the trade relationship, and they say, all right, we want a new deal. Now, some people in the European Parliament think that there's going to be a huge discussion about rejoining. I don't think that's as likely, but changes to this existing deal, how likely is that in your view, but also in practical terms? Are there any limitations as to when changes have to be made? And if changes aren't being made, will it be as complicated as this whole discussion we had for 4 years now? Or do you think there could be, on a rolling basis, reviews to existing agreements?
Very good question. On the first, I think we had a referendum in 1973. We had one in 2016. The question around our EU membership will always remain a political question, and it will never fully go away. What will change is that many will consider it settled for at least a few years, and let's see how, a bit like since the 1973 referendum, how the dynamics evolve over the next decade or two. I don't think there's any real prospect of the UK rejoining the EU anytime soon, and therefore we should focus on what deal we have now and how we best make that work and build a constructive, productive partnership between the UK and the European Union. In terms of making changes, so you have quite an elaborate governance structure in this deal, so topped by something called the Partnership Council, which a lot of people will hear about, but below that, many subcommittees, and these will be ironing out a lot of the details or new problems that emerge in the future, and that will in itself change things a little bit. In terms of big changes to the agreement that's more politically visible, if you like, it will be very interesting to see what happens when the review clause will come up. I think how political that becomes will depend on how things have gone over the last 3 or 4 years. It's entirely conceivable that it will be just a small box somewhere in the newspaper, as we saw a bit in with Brexit negotiations during the course of 2020, once Boris Johnson had secured a stonking majority, versus the previous years to that, where it was front page news every day. But changes are always possible, particularly when there's a political will or even necessity to do so.
So Alex, as my last question here, I know British people have this eternal optimism, even though there's been a lot of pessimism over the last 4 years. Looking out into the future, looking at as to how the UK is going to perform and how the UK is going to deal with the EU, are you optimistic?
So it's as has been well reported, a thin deal in many aspects on scope. So we talked about it not including foreign policy, for example, and substance. We talked about perhaps being able to go further on sanitary and phytosanitary provisions. As ever, though, I am characteristic to my British inheritance, remain very optimistic about the future. I think we do need to move on from what has at times been a very acrimonious debate over the last 4 years to a more positive vision. The UK is now out of the EU, and if we look forward, there are many global challenges which require UK and EU working together to provide global leadership. We've got the climate change conference at the end of this year. We've got the biodiversity conference this year, food sustainable summit. And the UK and the EU, despite all the differences that have sort of come to the surface over the last 4 years, remain very much aligned in terms of values, in terms of interests. And I've therefore I'm optimistic that the global agenda can help bring the two back together and see a positive future for both.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you're having a wonderful rest of the week. Stay safe and follow us on Twitter. Yes, we are on Twitter indeed. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have-